Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the final part of Sut Jolly's fine documentary, Advertising at the Edge of the Apocalypse, plus comedian Bill Hicks and more. I hope you'll stay tuned. I like this documentary a lot. It's very concise, yet it argues every one of its major points with good concrete specifics. The documentary's view of advertising is very comprehensive, covering the fields history and development, psychology, sociology, and, this one is especially important, advertising's key role in maintaining an economic system that is destructive to citizens and destructive to the planet. To be sure, advertising did not cause the devastation of our environment, but advertising is doing everything it can to aggravate the problem. We'll hear more about that in today's installment. I'm saying that advertising does such and such, but of course that is misleading. Advertising is an abstraction and a tool. Rather, there are people doing such and such, and they are the managers of corporate capitalism, acting on behalf of the major shareholders, and willfully blind to the damage to everyone else on the planet. Advertising is one of several tools they use to attain their ends. To its credit, the film keeps reminding us of this, too. It's not afraid to use the C word, capitalism. While the film is a video documentary, most of its meaning and its arguments reside in the words the narrator speaks. The video element pretty much just supplements the spoken words. So the film works very well on radio. Well, okay, today's part on sex in advertising depends a bit more on the visuals. Of course, advertisements mangle sexuality the way they mangle every other good thing in life. The visuals here, taken from video ads, display a very narrow spectrum of human beauty and human sexual behavior. All the women shown are young, all look like Victoria's Secret models, or Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. In short, babes. Thanks, but no thanks. Not my type. But I feel sorry for our country's young women, raised on advertising, who have been shown only this one style of possible beauty for themselves to imitate. But that particular style of female beauty does involve spending a whole lot of money on personal grooming products. So that's the one style of beauty that consumer capitalism pushes you to adopt. The male models, by the way, are in the same league. They all look like they just crawled out of the pages of GQ magazine. But enough of Ken's fashion do's and don'ts. Let us return to the final segment of the film. We'll begin with the second half of Chapter 4, All That Is Solid, and then on to Chapter 5, titled Optimism of the Will. Here is Sut Jolly with Advertising at the Edge of the Apocalypse.
In one of the latest quadrennial defense reviews, the Pentagon states explicitly that climate change poses a significant challenge for the United States and the world, saying that as greenhouse gas emissions increase, sea levels are rising, average global temperatures are increasing, and severe weather patterns are accelerating. And the evidence is now so clear that human behavior is what's driving all these destructive impacts that in 2000, the Dutch scientist Paul Crutzen proposed that we are now living in an entirely new geological epoch, the age of man, or what he called the Anthropocene. Since then, many others have agreed that the changes unleashed by an unbridled consumer capitalism on the planet are so profound and transformative that we are in a unique geological period deserving of its own designation. They've also pointed out that the Anthropocene is dangerous not just to the planet, but to the other species as well. The history of the world has been marked by a number of periods of mass extinction of species, where dramatic changes in nature caused mass die-offs. Scientists have identified five. The most well-known is the dying off of the dinosaurs about 64 million years ago. Some commentators, looking at the available evidence, have postulated that we are currently in the sixth mass extinction, or what a recent study called biological annihilation. And this one is a result not of changes in nature, but what human beings have done to destroy habitats and change the climate. But as Bill McGibbon reminds us, it's not all humans who have been responsible for this incredible damage to the Earth and to other species. The responsibility lies with the populations of the advanced consumer societies, us. He says, man's efforts, even at their mightiest, were once tiny compared with the size of the planet. The Roman Empire meant nothing to the Arctic or the Amazon. But now, the way of life of one part of the world in one half century is altering every inch and every hour of the globe. We've done this ourselves by driving our cars, building our factories, cutting down our forests, turning on our air conditioners. In the years since the Civil War, and mostly since World War II, we have changed our very atmosphere. When Marx and Engels wrote, "All that is solid melts into air," they couldn't have known that capitalism would one day literally melt the solids of the planet into air, or that all that melting ice would eventually lead to dramatic increases in sea levels, rendering coastal regions vulnerable to powerful storm surges caused by a growing chain of extreme weather events, from monster hurricanes that have plunged entire cities and towns underwater, to tornado outbreaks that seem to grow more frequent and extreme year by year. The link between these events and long-term climate change is now absolutely undeniable, as is the link to our use of fossil fuels like oil. The problem is that we as a society are addicted to our existing lifestyle and the fossil fuels that sustain it. Even our political leaders recognize this.
President George W. Bush.
America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world.
Imagine an out-of-control addict who has access to the largest military force ever assembled. What will that addict do to satisfy their habit? We don't need to speculate. We just need to look at their history. They'll make alliances with the most authoritarian, the cruelest people on the planet. People like the Saudi Arabian royal family, who happen to sit on one of the largest supplies of oil in the world. And this isn't something recent. Since the end of World War II, every American president, Democrat and Republican alike, has pledged allegiance to these brutal monsters. It doesn't matter that they're an autocratic monarchy that would be at home in medieval times, or that they funded and supported the rise of ISIS, because they have the drug we need. For the last 70 years, the basis of American foreign policy has been ensuring access to oil. That was the reason for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the people who paid the price, often with their lives, were those caught in the middle. The innocent civilians unlucky enough to live where the major energy sources are. Rather than finding ways to curb our consumption habits or break our reliance on fossil fuels, the US opted for a war that lasted more than a decade, killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and has cost the United States over $2 trillion. In the process, destabilizing the entire Middle East and unleashing the extremist forces that gave the world ISIS. And then imagine the recently addicted, like China and Russia, who also have access to large military forces, being added to this scenario. And the stage is set for confrontation of the most frightening kind. Imagine what will happen as the supply of the drug gets scarcer and scarcer, and the desperation of the addicts even more extreme. Military confrontation is guaranteed. And when there are nuclear weapons on both sides, the consequences will be catastrophic. It really does seem sometimes as though we are living at the edge of the apocalypse. That everything, socially, politically, militarily, physically, is coming apart. To get out of the situation will require us to think clearly and rationally. And there's a formidable alliance of military officials, scientists, environmental activists, and concerned citizens across the globe who have been pleading with us to start thinking about the long-term health of the planet and our children. But no matter how much they've tried to raise awareness of these issues, the voices of these people have been no match for the much more powerful voice of consumer capitalism, which speaks to us through the multi-billion dollar megaphone of the advertising industry, telling us loudly and constantly from virtually every available space in the culture that we should keep the carnival of consumption going without any concern. Don't worry, this endless parade of ads tell us, just party. The corporations that dominate the marketplace thrive in the here and now. Their success measured in quarterly reports, short-term profits, and their ability to advance their own immediate financial self-interest. And advertising normalizes this present-oriented mentality by targeting us with deeply emotional appeals that are designed to bypass thinking altogether. And there's nothing left to chance here. Over the last few years, the ad industry has made a science of targeting our emotions with something called neuromarketing. Rather than asking people to explain what they think of certain ads in focus groups, neuromarketers are actually hooking people up to electrodes and then looking inside their brains as they watch test ads, and then measuring how these ads stimulate the pleasure centers of the brain in real time, in order to get an unfiltered look into people's emotional responses to ad content. And as the competition to stand out and be noticed has gotten more cutthroat, these attempts to short-circuit people's rational thinking processes have only gotten more intense. Sexual appeals have long been a staple of advertising, but in recent years, some advertisers have taken it to a new level. Although these images emerged out of the fantasies of the mostly male directors and writers of commercials, because advertising has colonized everything, including our own fields of desire, they now seduce everyone, men and women alike, and they form the ground, the context within which we have to think about deadly issues like resource depletion, war, and climate change. They're the lens through which you have to think about the future. And our culture, dominated by advertising, simply does not provide us the tools to think in the long-term way that's required. Instead, in advertising, the time horizon is short. The dominant mode is the here and now. Ads tell us over and over again that immediate pleasure should be our first priority.
A tornado ravages a town.
The end of civilization is upon us. Hold your loved ones close.
Even when we know that times are dire and civilization is collapsing around us, ads encourage a nihilistic view that prioritizes pleasure in the present.
Inside a bar in town, a handsome man and a beautiful woman drink, flirt, and dance as the tornado rages.
The result of all this is a kind of collective suicide pact, where we've given up the idea of the future for a pleasure-filled present, a party to the end of the world.
The legend reads, Cuervo, tomorrow is overrated.
The challenge we face in the midst of this onslaught, this flood of images and stories that tell us only to think about the now and ourselves, is to somehow imagine another world, a sustainable world that's in sync with our deeply human desire for connection and sociability.
Chapter 5, Optimism of the Will.
The Italian socialist thinker Antonio Gramsci had a famous phrase to describe the process of politics, that it was a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the will. What he meant by that was that we have to confront the world as it is, understand it in the most forceful way, using all of our intellectual tools to see clearly what we're up against. And when we analyze the array of forces confronting us, we could be dismayed and distressed, pessimistic. But if we're serious about wanting to change the world in a more humane direction, the optimism of the will, then that depressing analysis is absolutely vital, as it shows us where the weaknesses are, where the fault lines are that we can press against, who our enemies are, as well as identifying our friends and allies. and I think there are reasons for optimism of the world. Firstly, more and more people aren't just sitting back and escaping into the consumer fantasy, but are taking to the streets. People like Bill McGibbon are desperately trying to draw attention to the ongoing climate catastrophe and build a mass movement for social change.
I learned one thing from Keystone and from all these other fights. It's that when we fight, we win.
And he's not alone. We've seen massive mobilizations by people committed to reversing climate change to assure there's actually a livable planet for themselves and for future generations. Other activists, such as those with Greenpeace, are confronting the fossil fuel industry on the front lines, and in the process, putting their own lives at risk. This is just one part of a growing movement that's been pushing back against the anti-democratic excesses of the system on multiple fronts. We've seen the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example, shine a light on the astonishing rates of economic inequality that plague the wealthiest consumer capitalist societies, exposing as pure mythology the neoliberal idea that economic growth automatically translates to prosperity and happiness for most people. And then we have a growing movement of artists and hackers that's been setting its sights squarely on the excesses and abuses of the ad industry itself. A self-described band of culture jammers are subverting and disrupting ads by remaking logos, reworking product images, and creating their own anti-ad appeals. In the UK, a group has been using a tactic called brandalism to transform the corporate billboards that have been colonizing more and more public space, refashioning them as anti-commercial, anti-consumerist street art. All of these forms of progressive resistance across these many fronts remind us of something crucial, that there's nothing natural or inevitable about the political economic system as it now exists. The system was created by certain institutions with certain interests at a certain moment in time, so it can just as well be transformed by people with different interests in mind. This rising awareness has forced corporations to increasingly use environmental themes in their own advertising, what's called green advertising, to appeal to people whose consciousness around climate change in particular has been raised.
Capturing the wind and putting it to good use. Wind energy from GE.
Even oil companies are getting in on the act, hoping we won't notice the sheer hypocrisy. Or the bottled water industry that sells itself as environmentally responsible and at one with nature.
Bottled at the source, untouched by man. It's Earth's finest water.
Even though it's stealing water from a region whose own population lacks access to clean water, and then burning huge amounts of energy to ship it halfway around the world in millions of plastic bottles that wreak havoc with the environment. I'm also hopeful about the fact that advertising is forced to use images of desire and satisfaction from another very different vision of society, one that's the opposite of what neoliberal capitalism delivers through products in the market. A world of meaningful work. A world of deep community life and friendship. A world where families are free of stress and can be families. A world of intimacy and love. A world of relaxation and fun. None of these things can be delivered by products. And what we have to do is disentangle them from their seeming connection with the market and capitalism and connect them to another vision of society that can actually deliver them. A world based on human values rather than the pursuit of blind profit. That's the great political challenge. How to connect our real desires to a truly human world, to a world of connection and sociability that's sustainable, rather than the dead world of things. And we need to remember one thing, that the advertising industry, and more than ever the public relations industry, wouldn't be spending all this money to maintain and push this elaborate corporate commercial vision of the world if they weren't afraid people might otherwise come to see the world through a different lens, one that's more in tune with social values rather than the hollow materialistic values of consumerism. In reality, the entire consumer capitalist system, at least as it's now constructed, is like a house of cards, built on a foundation of carefully crafted propaganda to make sure we stay emotionally invested in the system and on board with it. If we were to start thinking critically about capitalism and see that the system only works in the interest of a very small number of people on the planet, the whole consumer spectacle could come tumbling down. So they have to keep constantly persuading us with their propaganda to not see the reality of the situation. When President Dwight D. Eisenhower delivered his famous farewell address to the nation in 1961, we tend to remember his startling warning to the country about the dangers posed by the growing influence of American militarism and the American military.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Fewer people recall that Eisenhower went on to issue a second warning to the American people about the growing spiritual and political threat posed by capitalism and mass consumerism.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
He was pointing out how the needs of capitalism often exist in direct conflict with the needs of democratic societies. And he was directly challenging the American people to think critically about how a system built entirely around the need for short-term profits might pose a grave threat to the well-being of future generations. A year, 2 years, 10 years, 70 years down the road. That's the challenge he left us. And to meet it, we'll have to wake up from the dreams that advertising has seduced us with to develop more humane and practical collective solutions to the global crisis we're now facing. It's no exaggeration to say that not only the health of democratic societies, but the future habitability of the planet and our very survival as a species is at stake.
I like to do a song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz. That's it.
Satire by Janis Joplin. Nicely anticipating, maybe even summarizing, Satjali's fine documentary, Advertising at the Edge of the Apocalypse. Mercedes Benz was Joplin's last recording, made 3 days before her death in 1970. Back then, 50 years ago, we were not so aware of the damage to the environment fueled by consumerism and advertising. But Joplin did call out the never-ending cycles of covetousness urged by consumer capitalism and celebrated by advertising. A quarter century later, comedian Bill Hicks also had his fill of advertising. and the people who create it.
If anyone here is in advertising or marketing, kill yourself. Just a little thought. I'm just trying to plant seeds. Maybe one day they'll take root. I don't know. You try. You do what you can. Kill yourself. Seriously, though, if you are, do. No, really. There's no rationalization for what you do, and you are Satan's little helpers. Okay? Kill yourself. Seriously. You're the ruiner of all things good. Seriously. No, this is not a joke. It's going to be a joke coming. There's no joke coming. You are Satan's spawn, filling the world with bile and garbage. You are f***ed and you are f***ing us. Kill yourself. It's the only way to save your soul. Kill yourself. Plant seeds. I know all the marketing people are going, he's just doing a joke. There's no joke here whatsoever. Suck a tailpipe, hang yourself, borrow a gun from a Yank friend. I don't care how you do it. Rid the world of your evil machinations. Whatever, you know what I mean. I know what all the marketing people are thinking right now, too. Oh, you know what Bill's doing? He's going for that anti-marketing dollar. That's a good market. He's very smart. Oh, man, I am not doing that. You evil scumbags. Oh, you know what Bill's doing now? He's going for the righteous indignation dollar. That's a big dollar. A lot of people are feeling that indignation. We've done research. Huge market. He's doing a good thing. Damn it, I'm not doing that, you scumbags. Quit putting a damn dollar sign on every thing on this planet.
The late stand-up comedian Bill Hicks, a cultural critic who died too young at age 32 in 1994. Hicks and Janis Joplin form a nice two-part coda to Satjali's fine documentary, Advertising at the Edge of the Apocalypse. If you missed any part of this three-part series, you can pick it up without charge at our advertising-free website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Advertising at the Edge of the Apocalypse was produced in 2017 by the Media Education Foundation. New World Notes is produced once a week at the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, an advertising-free service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening. Advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that you can be sure if it's Westinghouse, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.